Okay, I'm sorry for the delay. Again, I am Steve Skeener, and this is CSE 373, AMS 373, algorithms class, analysis of algorithms. Let me just get my act together. How many people had trouble finding the room? Okay, how many people did not have trouble finding the room? Okay, it's good. Okay, so it's good to see everybody answered one way or another. It'd be good if we could, when I ask questions this semester, it'd be good if that happens all the time. Okay, let me start with the logistics. Okay, so this is a course on algorithm analysis. The prerequisite, I believe, is CSE 214, which is the data structures class. How many people have not had up to 214 the data structures class? Okay, is there anybody here who has not had data structures? Okay, so there would be some people, for example, people who took applied math. Okay? How many applied math people are there? Raise your hands, tall. Okay. How many people have? Okay. How many people have not had 214, the data structures class?
I think it's equivalent.
Oh, equivalent. If you have the equivalent, it's the equivalent. Okay. Okay. So, if you have not had data structures, listen carefully to what we say the first couple lecture. Look at the textbook and make sure that you're ready for the class. The applied math people sometimes have and sometimes have not had this, and that sometimes does or sometimes does not cause problems. You'll see over the next couple of, depends on what your programming maturity is and mathematical maturity and things like that are. But if you're unsure whether you have the prerequisites, you should come by and talk to me. The course will meet, again, twice a week, Tuesday, Thursday, until at least they change it, which hopefully they won't. Well, I don't really care one way or another, but... So we're meeting it right now at Art and Space 069. My office hours will be after class, okay, on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So don't be afraid to stop by after class and chat about anything. In the handout I gave you, our TA was not determined. We now do know who our TA is, at least temporarily. Okay, so Duke Bang is our TA. Stand up, okay? Give him a round of applause. Okay, so he will be grading the homeworks and the exams. He will be available for questions about some of the material and stuff like that. His office hours will be posted on the website along with his email address and stuff like that. So don't be afraid to look it up there. Any questions about the people? Okay, the textbook for the course will be this book, the Algorithm Design Manual. How many people have seen it? Is it in the bookstore? Have everybody proved it's in the bookstore? Okay, I happen to like this book. I think the guy who wrote it knows a lot. Okay, and so I personally like this book. The way I teach algorithms is maybe a little bit different than the way a lot of other people teach algorithms, and which may be good or may be bad depending upon your interests and skills and whatever. Algorithm design, as we will see, is a very tricky business. Okay, it's a this is the kind of a course that involves a lot of thinking. Okay, and in some sense proving things, but mainly thinking and trying to sort of create solutions to problems. And it really requires a type of thought and design that is different than a lot of other areas in computer science. Okay, this is a mathematical course. Okay, even though we're not going to really be using very high-powered mathematics, it's mathematics in the sense of ideas, and it's the kind of a course where, when given an algorithm problem, either you see the solution or you don't. Okay, and until you don't see the solution, you don't have anything, and so that makes it frustrating for a certain number of people because you'll sort of look at a problem, you can stare at it. Nothing happens, okay? And while somebody else who knows about algorithm design or is very clever can look at it, and in a second, woof, the problem's done, okay? So learning how to think and learning how to design algorithms is a tricky business in that regard. And so I try to spend a lot of time on what I would say design issues, more design than analysis. There is going to be, and so that's one of the differences in this course, is probably the way I teach it. We'll spend more time trying to do design and understanding of algorithms. We'll spend a little bit less time in what I would say traditional analysis techniques, things like recurrence relations and the big O notation and stuff like that. We're going to use them, we'll talk about them at the very beginning, we'll use them as needed. But it might Some of you who want a more formal treatment may well benefit by looking at some other books, okay? And a classic book to look at is this big book, the Corman, Lieserton, and Revest book. It may pay to look to get an alternate view of things if you're confused about things. Any questions? Okay, so the grading for the course is we're going to have every day, every lecture, I am going to be assigned. Okay, I'm not going to pass out a list of daily problems we're going to have in this course. So let me see if I can get this here. So every day at the beginning of class, I am going to go through the solution of a problem that I've assigned for that day. Okay? And the vision is you're now going to be getting a complete list of all the daily problems with what day we're going to talk about them. Let me pass these out. So starting with next class, there is going to be a daily problem due at the beginning of every class. And we are not going to be grading these problems particularly. What you're responsible to do is to turn in a one-page solution to the problem. I will promise you we will not read your solution. Okay? You have to put your name on it. We're going to count at the end of the semester how many solutions did you turn in over the course of the semester. And this 5% of your grade will be a, basically is counting how many solutions did you turn in. And the reason we're going to be doing this is you should be thinking before class about what the daily problem is. The daily problem is going to cover the material that we're going to talk, you know, based on, ideally on the material we talked about in the previous lecture. And because algorithm design is sort of tricky. Often, once you see the problem, the solution, it's often very easy and you can write it down. Until you know what you're doing, you can often see the solution and be completely wrong. And you don't have a good way to know about it. What I'm going to try to do with the daily problems is we will solve them the way I would solve them. Okay? And so hopefully you can get some intuition. You will have tried to solve these problems. You will have gotten some kind of a solution or not gotten a solution. And then maybe when you see my thought process when I try to solve them at the beginning of class, it will help you out. So the two reasons for doing the daily problems are, one, you will get 5% of your grade by turning something in each time. But more important, by getting your head into the problem and thinking about it, you'll be able to keep up with the material that we're doing and see whether you're thinking about this right or wrong, okay? Stuff like that. Any questions about daily problems? Okay. What I have found in the past is grades are amazingly well correlated with what percentage of the daily problems people turn in. Again, I will just, we're not going to look at your solution, okay? So I guarantee you it's not that the solutions were right, but sometimes just the act of thinking about the problems beforehand and trying to keep up with it makes a tremendous difference. So that's daily problems. The bulk of the work in this class will be 5 homework assignments. They're going to account for a total of 15% of the grade, okay? There's going to be then 2 midterms and a final. It's important to work hard on the homeworks because that's really where you're going to be learning the material. This is a course which involves a lot of problem solving. And, it takes a while till you sort of get the idea of how we do it. So I encourage you to work very hard on the homework assignments, even though that's, only 15% of the grade. Okay? To help you work on the homework assignments, I'm going to allow you to work in pairs on 4 of the 5 homework assignments. Okay, and encourage you to talk with each other to try to figure out how to solve these problems. Okay, the real guts of your grade are going to be on the midterm and the final, the midterms and the final. And so if you don't know how to solve the homeworks on the homeworks, you're not going to know how to solve similar problems on the exams, and you're going to get blown away. So I strongly encourage you to, basically the homeworks are so you can learn, and the midterms and finals are so you can demonstrate that. Any questions? Okay. The way I'm going to give the exams is that I have posted on my webpage a list of about 150 problems, okay? And I'm going to make you a promise that every single problem I assign to you on your midterm or one of your midterms or your final is already on my website, okay? So I've given you a list of 150-ish. Don't, if it's 200... that's 200. If it's 100, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever's on my website, whatever I have posted as my complete list of problems, I will promise you that all midterm and exam problems will be from that list. So this gives you something to study, okay? This gives you sort of a concrete way to study, namely, if you can figure out how to solve all the problems on the website, okay, you're going to do very well on the exam, okay? So, but again, it involves learning how to solve problems, okay? And I encourage you to work on, you know, so basically, if you work hard, if you try these problems, you figure them out, you ask for help from the TA and me and figure it out, you'll do okay, okay? On the other hand, if you wait till the night before and start trying to read this, it's just not going to work, okay? Yeah, of course, if you're smart enough and you understand the techniques, you don't have to have solved the problems before, okay? You could solve it right then. But if you don't know the techniques, you're not going to learn them in the last night before the midterm. Any questions? Okay, so you can look at that and see what's going on. What other rules are there? Again, the course webpage is www.cs.sunysb.edu/Kildaskina, S-K-I-E-N-A, /373. And all the course handouts are there. All the course homework assignments are there. Lecture notes from past semesters, lecture notes basically that I'll be using this semester, are there. Audio versions of lecture notes from past semester are there. Okay, so there's a lot of material there that might help you prepare. So I encourage you to check it out. Okay, any questions? What else will we say? Again, I will have put the lecture slides I've used from previous semesters. They're available from the course website. They're available in two formats. One is as an HTML thing, so you can click them and read them. There also is a PDF file that's available. It's about 300 pages long that will have all my lecture notes in there. If you have access to a printer at home and you want to print the 300 pages, that's good, okay? But don't print them on the CS departmental machine. It would be bad if I came in and saw 300 pages of lecture notes constantly being printed, okay? So, you know, use your own resources if you can do that. If some student wants to organize a consortium to go to the print shop and buy, you know, Xerox all the notes and buy books of those notes, that I would strongly encourage, okay? So if someone wants to take the lead on that, I would encourage that. Any questions about lecture notes? Okay? Again, you're going to be working on homework problems in pairs. Now, it's up to you to find a partner in general. So hopefully you know some people, you know, find somebody who's a friend of yours who's a partner and work with them. If you can't find a partner, come to me and I will assign you to somebody else who cannot find a partner. At most, one person in the class will not have a partner, and anyone who wants one will not have a partner under this scheme. Okay, so hopefully we'll work that out. What I don't want to hear is I'm happy to be a broker to get you guys together, but I will not be a counselor. I do not want to hear that your partner did not do any work on the homeworks, okay? I do not want to hear stories about how dumb or lazy your partner is, okay? This doesn't mean anything. Your partner will get burned on the exams. Don't worry about that. I will take care of that, okay? So work together with a partner if you think it will help you. If for some reason it's not working out with the partner, dissolve the relationship, I don't want to know about it, okay? Any questions? Yeah. Excuse me,
don't
you? I don't have syllabus. Are there any extra copies of the syllabus floating around? Okay, so let's get those circulating around. Again, in the long term, if you don't have any of these handouts, they are available on the website. Okay, so you can always print them or look at them there.
About the notes, can you produce multiple slides on
that page? Someone who wants to wants to discuss that should come back with me after in office hours at some point. We can discuss alternate ways of preparing them. Okay? So if there's some better way to prepare them, let me know. Okay? Any questions?
Do you have alternate office hours?
Do I have alternate office hours? I don't have alternate office hours, but if you need to see me and you can't see me after class, you can try to see me before class or send me mail and we can make an appointment. So I'm willing to make appointments to see people if that's necessary. The other thing, the TA, we have carefully designed the TA's office hours so they are on Monday and Wednesday. Mine are on Tuesday and Thursday, so in principle we have the world covered. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. So again, I encourage you to work in pairs. I encourage you to do the daily problems. I think that's very important. When you work in pairs, only one copy of the assignment is necessary to be turned in per pair. Okay? So I encourage you to sort of basically, you will turn in one copy of the assignment and both of you will sign it. Okay? Any questions? Again, if your partner doesn't do anything and is a louse, well, if he doesn't do anything, you don't have to let him sign the paper. But if it's a problem, break up and get another partner the next time. Any questions? Okay? Okay. With the homework assignments, I don't want you to use great length in describing it. I want every problem on one side of a sheet of paper. Okay? Is the size that I want each problem solved. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. What else is important? Again, this is a standard rule. If I find out people are cheating in this class, the primary way to cheat would be to try to copy on the midterm or one of the finals, or try to break into a computer system or something like that. If we catch you, we'll bring you up for disciplinary charges. If you have some kind of a disability that will interfere with what you're doing in here, let me know. And the clause is described on the sort of syllabus. The other thing I will say is that I know people's dogs die and grandparents get ill and things happen, and that people need or ask for extensions on a homework. The answer is you all have got one extension for free without asking, okay? Namely, on one of the assignments, you are allowed to turn in one of the assignments up to 1 week late, okay? I don't want to know why, okay? I don't want to know, but you're only allowed to do this once and you will not get a second option for this, okay? So if you're turning in your assignment, you write down, I am turning this late, this in late, okay? You're turning in late, turns your partners in late also, so you can't get two extensions by somehow picking your partners right and splitting or something like this. So, but if you need get into a crunch, you can turn in one assignment up to 1 week late, okay? Any questions about that? Okay, good. And homework is due at the beginning of class. One thing that is a fairly pointless thing is to say, oh my God, the homework's due today, I'll stay out of class, and this at the end, I'll work on it the last hour and a half during class, and then turn it in. Ideally, something interesting is happening in class that you're missing. So homeworks are due at the beginning of class, and I will snatch the papers at the end of the beginning of class, and the penalty for late will be 20% per day. Any questions? Okay. The other thing is I would like to get to know the people in this class as well as possible. So one of my plans is that a couple of times over the course of the semester, I will probably try to run a pizza with the prof. Namely, that I will have put a sign-up sheet outside my door, and the 5 to 10 people who sign up I will have pizza with you for lunch one day. Okay, and so there's a way we can get to know each other a little bit better and stuff like that. Any questions? Okay, one other way I would like to get to know you better is to make sure you sign up the sheet that says, so I know what the roster is. Let me see if I could get this here. Okay, so let me just pass this around while I'm thinking. I need to know what your name is. I need to know your email address. I need to know whether you're a major. And I need to know whether you're registered. Okay, and 1, 2, 3. So here, let me pass these things around. And when it finishes to everybody, let me know. Okay, any questions about the logistics? Yes. Okay, so some of you are, graduate students allowed to sign up, who want to sign up for this purpose, as 587. Again, as a graduate student, you're allowed to take a small number of undergrad classes as you're going to count towards your graduate degree. I don't know what that small number is. I think it is 2. Is that there? Okay. So if you want to take this as one of those classes, make sure it's one of the 2 that you want to take like that. I gather you can just register for 587 under my name, and this magically happens. A couple of people I know have registered for 587. So somehow that works. Okay? Any questions? Okay. Any other logistical or administrative questions? Okay, good. Let's just now go through what the lecture schedule is here. What are we going to talk about over the course of the semester? The first 3 weeks or so, the first 3 classes or so, we're just going to talk about the preliminaries of what is an algorithm and how do we keep score, okay? Namely, asymptotic notation, the big O notation. How many people here have seen the big O notation before? Okay, how many people have not seen the big O notation? Okay? Again, if you haven't seen something, raise your hand high enough for me to see these things. Okay? I know there's a natural embarrassment factor, but this is a way I get information back. Okay? Again, I think that a lot of students, the big O notation is sort of give us a language for talking about the efficiency of an algorithm. And we'll talk about that maybe a little bit today, but more seriously next class. And that is probably the hardest part of getting started in algorithm analysis, is understanding the big O notation. So, that's where you're expected to do some work. The next 3 classes, we're going to talk about some of the basic data structures that that are, let's say, most useful for designing algorithms, things like binary trees and priority queues, heaps, things like that. And the first homework will focus basically on data structure problems and the big O notation. And then we're going to have 3 lectures on different sorting algorithms, okay, and how you analyze them and stuff like that. Any questions? For most people, in principle, the first third of the semester should sound almost like it's a review of 214 in some way. And I don't know if that's, how many people does that sound like, at least now? Does it sound like it's 214? Okay. We're going to be going into things at what I would say is a more conceptual level and it's a different level. In a data structures class, you're hopefully learning how to program these things. You're learning about where do the pointers go in a binary search tree and stuff like this. Here, we're not going to be worrying. We're going to say, okay, what is a binary search tree? A binary search tree lets you search in log n time. Now, what can you do with that? Okay? And so it's important to understand how these things work. But in principle, we're going to be thinking at a higher level than code most of the semester. The assignments we're going to be working on are mostly going to be paper and pencil exercises rather than programming assignments. There'll be a little programming on several of the assignments. Okay, but mostly we're thinking about this on a conceptual level. Yeah. Use whatever language you like. Okay, it's best that it run on a computer. But other than that, that's really my only real issue here. Okay, any questions? Okay, so then we're gonna have the midterm. We'll be up to here, and then after the midterm, we're gonna be getting the material that I think is almost certainly new to everybody. And again, I don't want to get too cocky if you've taken 214. I mean, the stuff that before that is going to sound like review, but I think we're going to be going into this in more depth and in different angles than what you're used to seeing. After the midterm, we'll start talking about dynamic programming, which is a very, very powerful algorithm technique for finding fast ways to find algorithms on ordered things, things like strings, things like leaves of trees. It's a very, very powerful optimization technique, and we'll spend a couple of classes talking about that. We're then going to go into a brief section on combinatorial search, backtracking and brute force search. And homework 3, which is going to come out here, is going to be the one serious programming assignment of the semester. Namely, for homework 3, I'm going to give you a problem for which there is no known efficient algorithm for, other than basically brute force search. And you have to write the fastest program you can for that particular problem, and we will have a race contest in the class. The fastest programs will win a prize, the slowest programs will win a prize. But you don't want to win that slow prize.
In terms of
time efficiency. So basically, the rules, we'll talk more about that later, but the rules are I'm going to give you a programming problem, and you're going to be graded on what is the largest input you can solve within 1 minute of time, okay? And I think we will find that there's going to be a dramatic difference between the fast programs and the slow programs, okay? I will go on record as saying the fastest programs in here will be millions of times faster than the slowest programs, okay? But you know, it will be, we'll get to that point when we talk about backtracking, but that will be a programming assignment. It's somewhat serious. Any questions? Then, after that, we'll talk about graph algorithms. Again, hopefully you know a little bit about graphs, okay, you know, vertex and edge type graphs. We'll talk about the data structures to represent them, how to traverse them. We'll talk about, you know, the main algorithms on graphs that you see, the classic algorithms, for instance, finding shortest paths, minimum spanning trees, topological sorting, things like that. Any questions? Okay, and that's going to then take us up to the second midterm. The last part of the course is going to talk about problems for which there do not exist fast algorithms. Okay, it's somehow, when given a problem, ideally you want to find a fast algorithm to solve it. Okay, there's some problems for which nobody knows a fast algorithm to solve it. And there could be one of two reasons. One is people haven't figured it out. The other is that there may not be any algorithm for it. And the last part, of course, we'll talk about the theory of NP completeness, which gives you a way to, in some sense, prove that it's very, very unlikely that a problem has a fast algorithm. So for an algorithm analyst, you know, when given a problem, I can usually either find a fast algorithm for you or show you that such an algorithm doesn't likely exist. Okay? Yeah. Okay, so
you may not have a fast algorithm, but
so that's a good point. We're going to get to we'll talk about what we mean by fast and what we mean by correct in a few minutes. Okay, so my definition, I'm only interested in here in correct algorithms. Okay, so I'm not going to be interested in heuristics that come close to giving you the right answer. Okay, in this class we're only going to be dealing with well-defined problems and algorithms that give you the correct answer or do not give you the correct answer. Okay, and then we're most interested, of course, in algorithms that give you the correct answer quickly. Okay, we're not interested in the broken limbo, this limbo land of algorithms that don't always give you correct answers, but are fast. I mean, you know, it's very easy for me to write down a piece of garbage very quickly. Okay, but you know, the hard part is trying to solve the problem correctly. But we'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Any questions? Okay. And so then we will talk about the theory of intractability, and finally end up on with a final exam. Any questions about the order of the course? Okay. How many people in here, out of curiosity, are taking or thinking about taking my 392 Programming Challenges class? People, okay. Fair enough. Okay. So I am offering this semester a undergraduate special topics class in programming challenges, which is basically a algorithm-oriented programming course, where each week there's going to be a bunch of programming problems to solve, which have algorithm bases in it. That course is it's a special topics course. It's not something that you can use for too many places in your graduation requirements. 373 is an important class because you need it to, essentially you need it to graduate, okay, I guess 303 to graduate. Okay, the other course is not have that property. But if you decide that you're really interested in algorithms, and you may want to think about looking at that course as well. Okay, any questions? Okay, you can go to my webpage. You should be able to see that. Any questions? Okay, good. So any questions about logistics or anything about the administrative stuff before I move into more technical material? Okay, so this is a course about algorithms. And so the first question is, what is an algorithm? And the way I think of it, at least think of algorithms, I think of algorithms as, in some sense, being the ideas behind a computer program. Okay? Somehow when someone is designing an algorithm, an algorithm is basically a procedure to solve a problem, okay? A sequence of steps that will solve a particular problem. And the important thing is that the algorithm is somehow independent of the program, okay? When I describe the quicksort algorithm, you can program it in C or Java or Pascal or whatever you want, and the algorithm is somehow unchanged, the basic sequence of steps, the basic idea, the basic properties. So basically what an algorithm is, if it's interesting, The important thing is it's got to solve a general, well-specified problem. Okay? And by solving it, what I mean is that it has to always guarantee that it gives me a correct answer on any reasonable input. And by reasonable, I mean that any, let's say, any possible input. Okay? So, for example, we're going to be talking about problems this semester. An example of a problem, when I talk about a problem, an algorithmic problem, would be something like sorting. Okay? How do we describe a problem? A problem is described by a class of possible inputs. Okay? And it's described by an output specification. Okay? So how would I describe what sorting is? Sorting takes as input a sequence of n numbers. Okay? And as output, reorders the numbers, such that the first element output is less than the second, less than or equal to the second output element, less than or equal to the third output, so on. Okay? So this is a specification of a problem. Now notice it's a little bit different than an instance of a problem. When I talk about a problem of sorting, I mean I'm describing an abstract problem like this. I am not saying the numbers 7, 19, 36, 23, sort them. That's an instance, that's an input to a problem. Okay? But a sorting, but an algorithmic problem that we're going to be talking about is a well-defined problem where you have a well-defined input, well-defined output, and there's no question, if I give you the output, there's no question of whether it is the right answer or not. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So, a problem, if you say, well, give me a problem that's going to predict the weather tomorrow. Okay? Well, that's not a well-defined problem somehow, because exactly what do you mean by the weather? Okay? And is there an exact answer? If I say if it's sunny, is that good as saying if it's 36 degrees? You have to describe exactly what you want the output to be and exactly what the input is. Okay? Any questions? Okay? And an algorithm is correct if we can prove that it always returns the desired output, okay, for any given legal input. Okay? Any questions? Okay? This should, in some sense, be obvious. But the issue of correctness is not always easy to prove. How many people? Okay, let's see. How many people here have seen Quicksort? Okay, most people have seen Quicksort. Quicksort, if I remember, again, we'll talk about Quicksort when we talk about get to sorting. But can someone give me a quick description of why Quicksort is correct? Why do we know that what is Quicksort doing, if I remember correct? It picks an element, an arbitrary element, throws all the keys to the left of it that are less than it, all the keys that are greater than it to the right of it, and then sorts each part, right? Now, why do I know that that's correct? Okay, and it's very easy to state Quicksort. I have just done that, and I think anybody who's seen Quicksort will recognize that as the algorithm. But somehow, in order to really claim it's an algorithm, you need to give a proof of correctness. Okay? And they have to prove that it works for all possible inputs, okay? Including flaky inputs. So, for example, does the input sorted? The input is already sorted. What does Quicksort do? Okay? Is the algorithm going to be right? Okay? If it contains repeated elements, how does it behave? It doesn't say this thing, doesn't say anything about the numbers being distinct. Will the Quicksort algorithm you give me work if I give you an input of 100, where all the numbers are 100? Okay? So you've got to be very careful about your algorithm. You have to prove that it will work on all possible inputs. Any questions? In this kind of a course, in general, we're going to spend, for a lot of the problems, correctness is sort of obvious. Okay? But obvious is a slippery thing. Okay? And so you always have to remember that we're interested in both correctness and efficiency. Okay? And one, you have to make sure you keep both dimensions intact. Any questions? Okay, so let's look at a genuine algorithm problem, which is what I want to argue is maybe a better example of why correctness is not necessarily obvious. So here is a problem that I was once given by a company, actually, on Long Island, that made a printed circuit board testing equipment. Okay? If you open up the back of your computer and pull out the boards and lift one up, on the back of it you will probably see you know, there is solder connections, and somehow the components, the CPU and all these components have to get soldered to the back of the board, okay, in order for there to be electrical connections between, you know, between all the components. So his company was basically basically had the following problem. They had a robot arm, okay, whose job it was to solder things, okay? And they were going to be wanting to program this robot so that they could assemble printed circuit boards. So what was their problem? On the back of the printed circuit board were a bunch of holes. The components were going to be stuck on the other side of the printed circuit board. And only the wire was going to stick out outside the hole. They wanted to build, to program the robot arm so that it would solder every single point on the back of the circuit, you know, travel from one point to another on the printed circuit board, okay? So as to solder all the connections. And they were concerned, obviously, they have to solder all the connections. But what criteria would they want to also satisfy? In addition to make sure they solder all the connections. What would be, let's say, the efficiency issue if you were building a robot like this? Yeah. You want to minimize the time that the robot arm has to travel, right? So one way that you could solder the robot, program the robot, is to take the point from the bottom and go to the leftmost, that they go from left to right. The chunk, the chunk, the chunk, the chunk, the chunk. Okay? The time that it will take to assemble the board is proportional to the length of the tour. Does everybody agree that basically it's got to go at every point? So you're going to pay N time it takes to go plus the time it takes for the robot to travel, which if the motion is constant, okay, for unit distance, is the length of the tour. So the problem that they really wanted to do was, given a set of points, find the tour that visits all those points using as small motion as possible, okay, as little distance as possible, okay? One algorithm that I just developed was, you can always go from, take the point from bottom to top. Is that going to minimize the distance traveled? Okay, if I consider the points from bottom to top? Okay, I see some no people thinking no. Can anyone come up with an example of a tour where you can't? An input where that's going to do a lousy job? Yeah? Say two stripes of points? Okay, so right. So one place where that would do very badly, and unfortunately we don't seem to have... Does anybody have... No one happens to have a marker that would legally write on this, do they? Okay. So, but I think that the vision that everybody has is right, that if the points were here slightly higher, the robot arm's going to go bzz, 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 okay? Where the right tour would be up, down, okay? So certainly doing them from bottom to top is not the right answer. Can anybody suggest an algorithm that is going to give me the shortest possible tour? Okay, I want to suggest some other approach. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I quite know what you're saying. So you're saying you start out at some point.
Yeah.
And then do what?
And then you find the shortest path to another point.
Which point is closest to it, you mean?
Yeah. And then just keep doing it.
So you're saying you want to start out at one point, find the closest point to it, and then find which is the unvisited closest point to it, and which is the unvisited closest point to it, and that's basically what your algorithm is, right?
Not really. It's going to be like a tree where it kind of like goes through all the points, explores all the points, and then find out the eventual, like how long the path
is. Okay, let's try the first version of your algorithm. Okay, or my algorithm, the one that I tried to put in your mouth. Okay, if you may deny it's yours, but okay. But I'll claim at least some people in this room were thinking about the following kind of an algorithm. Would be you start with one point, okay, and then you go to the point that is closest to it, And then from that, go to the next unvisited point that is closest to it. Closest to it, closest to it. Until you run out of points and then come back home. How would that do on this problem where we have two sets of points here and two sets of points here? Would that do a good or bad job on that input? Okay. Any ideas? Good? I think good, right? What's going to happen? It's going to go bit, 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 and back. Okay? So on that input, certainly the nearest neighbor tor would do very well, right? Does the nearest neighbor tor always do well, however? Does it always give me the right answer? How many people think it does? Yeah, I set you up, so hopefully nobody thinks it does. But how, can someone give me an example where it doesn't do well? Where it doesn't necessarily give me the right answer? Okay? Okay, is there anybody? Yes? Where the points are equidistant from one another. Well, that's, you have to be a little bit careful, because what you mean exactly by that. 3 points can be equidistant because they're an equilateral triangle. A bunch of points equidistant on a circle, more of them, then in fact it would do the exact same, the right thing. It would walk around the circle. Okay, so that's not necessarily a bad input. Yeah?
We have like three or four points.
We have 2 or 3 points that are more or less equal. So you're saying that the kind of trouble that you might get into is what if we have more than one point that is equidistant? Okay, then we have to make a decision, who do we go to next? Okay? And that potentially requires some explanation. Okay? And it, that kind of an idea I can use to construct an example where this nearest neighbor heuristic does very badly. Okay? So let's look at the following example here to show you that, again, the nearest neighbor tor, I think the algorithm we know, we always walk to the closest point. I think this algorithm is easy to understand. I think this algorithm is what I would consider to be efficient. We'll talk about efficiency when we talk about the big O notation. But basically, that's an order n squared algorithm, and that's okay. Okay, efficient to me is anything that's going to be less than exponential. Okay? So, and, or at least, you know, you want to get it as efficient as possible. But if you could do this problem in n squared time, I'd be very impressed. Okay? So, it's efficient, but it's not correct. Here's an example where the nearest neighbor heuristic does extremely badly. Suppose we have to start out from this point over here, and there are 2 points that are a distance one to the left and one to the right. Somehow we've got to pick the nearest one. Let's say we happen to go to the right. Okay? Now I'm a distance of 2 from that point that I otherwise could have picked. But now let's say there's another point that's 2 away from this. Okay? I now again have a choice. I could go here or here. What if I decide to pick the one that now goes to the left? Okay? Again, if you look at this construction, now I'm 4 from here and 4 from there. Okay? I claim that what the heuristic is going to do under this case is zigzag back and forth, left, right, left, right. Okay? Does everybody sort of agree that that's what the heuristic might very well do? And you say, well, wait, what about ties? Doesn't this require ties? I could break the ties in my favor by making this slightly more than 1 here, and this slightly more than, you know, slightly less than 1, that's slightly less than 2, and this slightly less than 4. So I don't require there be exact ties in order to get the behavior I want. Okay? But what's going to happen? You're going to zigzag back and forth on this example. What is the optimal tor on this example? Okay? Just go from left to right. We're going to have to get back there. Okay? This it's clear that your solution to this is much, much worse than optimal. Okay? If you were given the job of programming the robot, say, oh, I'm writing this great printed circuit board testing program. You can imagine what would happen if your boss saw the machine trying to debug, to solder this machine by going left to right, left, right, instead of this going. Okay? So nearest neighbor is a good example of a heuristic. It's a logical procedure. It's a reasonable thing. but it does not yield us provably the right answer. Okay? Any questions? It might not be obvious that it didn't work. Okay? But when you design a program, when you give me a proposed algorithm, you had better give me a proof of correctness. Not just say, well, I can't find anything wrong with it. Just saying you can't find a bad example doesn't mean one doesn't exist. Okay? We're in the business of coming up with algorithms and proofs of correctness. Any questions? Any other ideas of heuristics for TSPs? Yeah.
Ones that we have in the set, we put them as black dots. So we start with one dot,
multi-black,
and then we look at the rest of the white dots, and then find the closest black dot that the white dot can connect to.
Okay.
So then we have another black dot, one last white dot.
Okay. Okay, so what I think what you're saying is something like this, okay? Okay, first of all, if you're starting out with one, you're saying that basically you're going to have two sets of points. Ones that you sort of know part of their connection to the Tor, and other ones you don't know anything about. Okay, and you're looking for the closest edge, the shortest distance you can add to connect two points in order to build another part of the Tor. But not necessarily starting from the first point. So with this algorithm, I said start from the first point and go to the closest one. Okay, and then continue from here. What you might have said is, wait a second. Why are you always walking? If I took the first step from here to here, why do I have to connect from here? Why don't I connect from the original point? That's what you're trying to avoid, right? You're trying to say, no, wait, why don't I just use the shortest pair of the shortest distance, okay? Does everybody sort of see that idea? Now it's not a nearest neighbor tour. Now it's a closest pair kind of thing. She's taking the closest pair of points, saying, I'm going to connect you. I keep connecting the closest pair of points until she has a tour, okay, or runs into some kind of trouble. Any questions about that heuristic? It's a perfectly reasonable heuristic, okay? In fact, so reasonable, I even wrote it on the slide. Okay. Does this so basically, what's the heuristic? From one to n, for each pair of points, find the closest pair of points that are not yet connected, and connect them by an edge, and then repeat. Okay. That's basically what she's doing. And you have to take care to make sure you don't create points that are connected to three things, because then that's not a cycle, right? But, you know, basically connect them in tours so that we always connect the closest pair first. Does that always give us the right answer? Okay. How will that do on this well, let's take a look at this example here. Okay. I'll claim, actually, if you look at the original example, the one that motivated this algorithm, it probably does the right thing. The closest pair was this. The second closest pair was this. The next closest pair is that. The closest pair algorithm would do the right thing on this example. Does everybody agree with that? But what does it do on the following example? Okay? On the following example, what do I have as my situation? Okay? I am going to say that here I've got points arranged in such a way that they are close into two lines, such that the lines are closer to each other than the spacing between the points on the line. Okay? So let's think what this is doing here. Okay, I've got two lines of points, but I'm going to insist that the distance from here to here is going to be 1, and the distance from here to here is going to be 1.1, or something like that, slightly longer than 1. So what is the heuristic going to do? It's going to say, this is the closest, this is the closest, this is the closest, this is the closest, this is the closest. Then what's the closest remaining pairs? Well, I can't connect these together because now I'm going, I'm basically now going to connect pairs from that are a distance 1 plus, this is slightly more than 1, and I'm going to get that zigzag. And the only way to complete it would be with this long diagonal. I say if you do the calculations, it's clear that this cycle is going down the two lines and connecting at the ends is going to be substantially shorter than this algorithm. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay, I guess, can I give you a proof that this is, you know, I mean, if you calculate it, this is going to be about 22% longer than this. Okay? You have to do the geometry. Remember Pythagorean theorem and things like that. You can do the geometry and convince yourself of that. Okay? Any questions? So I claim the nearest neighbor heuristic is not, the closest pair heuristic is not going to work. Her original heuristic was a little different than this one, in that she's saying that she wants to always maintain a connected tour but grow it from either side. That was really sort of what you were thinking about. That one, I assure you, is equally wrong. Okay, maybe not in this example. Okay? Can someone give me a correct heuristic, a correct program? One that might be very, very slow, but someone give me a program that is guaranteed to be correct on any input. Okay, give me an algorithm for correctness. Yes. Try every possible path. Okay? So what could we do? We do know that every single possible path is described by a circular permutation on n things. Right? So why do I say that? Let's take a look at this thing. How many tours are there going to be? If we have n points, how many tours can be made on n points? Does anyone not want to know? Okay, is it n factorial? Well, n factorial is the number of permutations on n things. Does that make sense? That if I have, but how many tours are there on, let's say I give you 3 points. How many different distinct tours are possible on 3 points? Is it 3 factorial or 6? Yeah. But you say you could start at any given point, but the important thing is if it's a closed tour, it's going to end where it starts. So it doesn't really matter where you start. So in fact, we can always say it starts from vertex 1, and then a permutation of any one of the n minus 1 other things would describe the complete tour. Okay? So I would claim that there are n minus 1 factorial tours, if you set, you know, because it's circular. Okay, there's n minus 1, there's n factorial permutations, but since a tour has the same starting point as ending point, without loss of generality, we can say it starts at item 1. So that's why it's n minus 1 factorial. But here we're just playing games. N minus 1 factorial is a lot. Okay? But a correct algorithm would be, try all possible tours. For each tour, okay, count up what are the cost of the edges on that tour, and pick the permutation which gives you the smallest total edge cost. Is this algorithm correct? How can you prove it's correct? Can someone give me a convincing correctness proof? Yeah? Right. It's trying every possible tour. The correct answer is a possible tour. Okay. If I've tried all of them, and I know I've kept track of the smallest one, I know I'm giving you the smallest one. So this one is definitely correct, but is it efficient? Okay? I claim that anything that takes n factorial is something that grows very, very fast. It's so fast that 20 factorial is higher than you could ever hope to try to compute on any kind of a computer. Okay? So long as they wanted to solve this for 10 points, maybe this would work. Okay? But if someone wanted to find the optimal solution for the printed circuit board, okay, you should go to them and say, yes, I will give you an optimal tour, but you better pay me by the hour while the program runs. Okay? Then I'd be in good shape. But make sure they pay you as you go along and not wait for the solution. So what is the problem? We have now seen that several sort of obvious algorithms that you could sort of come up with, rules you could come up with here. Hey, why don't we try that? Why don't we try that? They gave us incorrect answers, okay? And we don't give points in this class for incorrect answers. Okay, we give points for correct answers, We give points for the fastest possible correct answer. This problem, you have a correct answer but a slow algorithm. Can you find a faster algorithm for this? The answer actually is no. Okay, interestingly enough. Remember I told you that the last part of the class we're going to talk about certain classes of problems for which there are not known algorithms for, and good reasons to believe there are not fast algorithms for? Well, it turns out that this problem, which is called the traveling salesman problem, has the property that it's NP complete, meaning that there is almost certainly no fast algorithm for it. So now you can go to the boss and say, well, yeah, you know, I can't find a fast algorithm, but that's because one doesn't exist. And that's a much better place to be, rather than just to say, I can't find a fast algorithm because I'm not smart enough. Okay? So that's why learning how to prove that fast algorithms don't exist is going to be a useful part of our business, as well as proving that finding fast algorithms if they do exist. Any questions? Okay, any questions about the traveling salesman problem? Or yes? Okay, so you happen to be right that there are heuristics, we'll call them heuristics in here, that will come close to the exact answer, but will not necessarily find the correct answer. There's no reason why those things don't necessarily exist. Okay, we're not going to spend much time talking about them in here. This semester, at the very last lecture of the semester, if I have time, I'll probably talk about those kind of heuristics. Okay, so in fact, what you would really like is to say, well, if the problem is NP complete and you can't solve it exactly, maybe you could come up with an algorithm that always comes close. That's really what you're sort of saying. Okay, and that's a respectable thing to be doing. We're not really going to talk about that very much in here, but certainly such algorithms exist for such problems, for certain problems. Yes? No, right now what we're interested in is a little different. It's not that we're not interested in mathematical answers. We're interested in learning techniques to find exact problems, if they exist. Okay? So the kind of the world that we're living in is you want to be able to look at a problem and find if there is an efficient, correct algorithm for that problem. And the techniques we will learn in this class, things like dynamic programming, things like certain graph traversal algorithms and things like that, are aimed towards finding the optimal answer efficiently. For many problems, such algorithms exist, as we will see. Okay, and that's what we're going to be trying to learn in here. So we're not going to focus on engineering solutions. Oh, this usually works well in practice. I don't know what practice is. Okay, so we're not going to talk about that. We're going to be interested in algorithms that always find the right solution efficiently. Okay, and again, there's another class of work which you're talking about which is a little bit different and which is important, but we're not going to get into that very much this semester. Okay, any questions? The reason for focusing on correctness and not engineering solutions is because it's important to be able to recognize when a correct solution exists. Okay? And this is something that, I mean, anybody can come up with a crazy idea for something that might sort of work. Okay? But the ability to look at a problem and come up with a correct, efficient algorithm if one exists is a difficult skill to master and still very important. I have gone into industry fairly often, and somebody has said, oh yeah, we have this problem, but we solved it with this heuristic. I said, yeah, but it doesn't always give you the right answer. And I said, well, they said, but it comes close. I said, how do you know it comes close? Well, sort of looks good. I said, why do you do it this way? You'll always get the right answer. And then they step back, okay? So that's what we want to be able to do, is to have the intellectual skills to look at a problem and say, this is how you do it correctly and efficiently, okay? Any questions? Okay, good. Fair enough. Okay, any questions about correctness or any other things here? Again, how bad, by the way, are the acoustics in this room? People in the back, can you hear what I'm saying? Can you hear what people who are asking questions are saying? Oh, really? So maybe they're not as bad as I thought. Okay, yes. There's a ringing noise. Is it me, or is there any obvious thing that I should do about it? Let's try this as an experiment, okay? If we go back here, are people ringing? Is my
you still have ringing? Do people prefer me to be down here?
Are you wearing a microphone?
No, I'm not wearing a microphone.
You're supposed to
Is this better? How many people think me standing here is better? Raise your hand if this is better. Raise your hand if this is worse. Raise your hand if it doesn't matter. Okay, I'm hearing a lot of doesn't matters. We'll think about this. Okay. Any questions? Okay. If the ringing bothers you, let me know. Okay, and we'll see what we can do. I'll see if there's a microphone here that can be turned off or suppressed in some way. Okay. So let's talk about efficiency. Okay. One of the issues in efficiency is this question of, why don't I just use a bigger computer? Okay, so a lot of people will say, what do you mean is, why do you want to design an efficient algorithm? I have a Pentium running at 2 gigahertz. Or I have a room full of Pentiums running at 2 gigahertz. Okay? The interesting thing is that we will prove. When we analyze algorithms in terms of the big O notation, an algorithm that is a big O, that has improved big O performance over another algorithm, the faster algorithm theoretically will beat the algorithm, a faster algorithm running on a slower computer will always beat a slower algorithm on a faster computer for a big enough input. Okay? So that is why we're going to be worried about efficiency. If you completely ignore efficiency, you get into problems like this idea of searching all possible tours, okay? Searching n factorial tours, it's not going to be a subtle point that is not efficient enough for you. If you try it on 10 points, you'll get an answer back in a few seconds. When you try it on 20 points, you will never get back an answer, okay? So there is definitely, efficiency matters on that scale. And on a lot of other problems, it also does matter, okay? Usually, inputs don't have to be so large before the faster algorithm beats the faster computer. Okay, and that's why we're going to worry about efficiency. Any questions about that? Okay. The other thing that we need to talk about in here is this notion of expressing algorithms. How are we going to talk about algorithms? Algorithms, remember, are procedures for solving problems. They're supposed to be computer independent. One way you could describe an algorithm would be to just write a program for it. If you have an algorithm for solving shortest path, you can program it in Java, and that's a complete description of the algorithm. But that's that requires a fair amount of work to get it right in Java and things like that. The algorithm we're going to be talking about, we're not going to go to the point of programming them in general. Okay? What we're going to be doing is we're going to want to write them in either pseudocode or English. For certain algorithms, like the ones we described here, the nearest neighbor TSP Tor, or the closest pair Tor, I could describe the idea to you in English, okay? Or I could have shown you this little sort of procedural language here, okay? Namely, if you look at it, this is a special language I just made up for expressing algorithms. Or all the permutations. Do something. What language has all the permutations as a primitive? The answer is my pseudocode does. Okay, so you can describe algorithms in here either as English descriptions or as a programming language where you basically make up the commands that you need as you need them. That's called pseudocode. The important thing is that we have to be able to understand it. Okay, so how do we know whether your algorithm description is legal? It's if we can understand it. If we can't understand it, then it's wrong. Okay? And that's the specification here. Any questions? Okay? But the important point is that we're not going to have to, in general, specify things at the level of detail of code. You know about pointers. You know how pointers operate and things like that. We're now going to talk about specifying them at a higher order level. Okay? But just enough so that we can describe the procedure clearly enough that someone could take that and program it. Okay, and get the basic idea. Any questions? Okay, very good. Okay.
When we talk about efficiency, what time? Class ends what? At 3:40. Okay, so we have about 10 minutes, right? Less than 10 minutes, is that right? Okay. Where's the sign-up sheet? Has the course sign-up sheet? Okay, so how many people have not yet signed the course sign-up sheet? Okay, so we have to talk at least long enough for these people to sign up. Okay? So what are we going to be talking about in here? Can I see the daily problems for a second? I gave them out. The first daily problem. Let me just look at that. Okay, I see. Okay, never mind. I see what that is. Okay, good. So how are we going to be counting the efficiency of algorithms? Okay? The thing that we're going to have to do, if we're going to be describing algorithms as a, let's say, a machine-independent idea, okay, we have to sort of have a model of what computers do. So when you talk about the efficiency of an algorithm, we're going to be describing the efficiency of the algorithm on some kind of a abstract model of what a computer is, okay? Sometimes when you're describing it in a programming language, you're describing it on a very concrete model, okay? Namely, what is the CPU on that computer? How fast does it execute all the instructions? The reason why algorithms can be talked about in a machine-independent way is because there's a fairly natural model of how much time it takes to execute an algorithm, okay, on a typical computer. Something we're going to call the RAM model of computation. On a RAM model of computation, we're going to be assuming that every simple step, okay, on the computer takes one step. It takes one computron to do a plus, an addition. It takes one computron to do a subtraction. It takes one computron to assign a variable to something else. It takes one computron to execute an if statement. Okay? What is a computron? It is the smallest unit of computation that we define. Okay? It's a step. Okay? There is no such thing as a computron. A computron is just a step. Okay? But what we're going to be doing when we count the efficiency of an algorithm, really what we're going to be doing is counting how many steps would an algorithm execute over the course of it, on the course of executing over a particular input. So when we access a memory location, that costs us one computron, one step. When we go through a loop that goes from one to n, it does not cost us one step, because it depends upon how big n is, correct? 4i goes from 1 to 100 is going to take longer than 4i goes from 1 to 2. So when we use our RAM model of computation, we're going to count simple things as taking one step, okay? And more complicated things are going to be proportional to the size of what they contain. A loop is going to take as many, it's going to basically take, if it goes from 1 to n, it takes n steps, okay? A subroutine. How much time does it take to call a subroutine? Well, it depends what that subroutine is. The subroutine just sort of said print out one, it takes one step. If the subroutine got into an infinite loop, it takes forever. Okay? So basically what we're going to be doing is, in a subroutine we're going to be counting the number of steps that are done in that subroutine. But basically, the basic primitives of each programming language, each basic primitive takes one step. And we're going to be measuring the efficiency of an algorithm in terms of how many steps does it take over the course of an input. Okay? By counting things in terms of steps, we avoid details about machine cycles. I don't need to know how fast your Pentium runs. Okay? That each step happens in 1 billionth of a second or 1.2 billionth of a second. Doesn't make any difference. We're only going to be counting how many steps get done. Okay? And this is what we mean by the RAM model of computation. Okay? Any questions? Now, what some people may argue is that this is not really true. Okay? That if you try to multiply two numbers together,
In a typical computer, does it take longer to do a multiplication or an addition? It would have took 220, which is multiplication. According to this, how much time does a multiplication of two numbers take? One step, okay? One computron. It's the same as one addition. So is this model correct? The answer is, of course it's not correct, okay? But it's a good approximation of reality, okay? And it's an approximation of reality out of the product that it's almost correct, okay? Or correct over the scale of what we want to do, okay? While still being easy to think about. In general, we like models that enable us to think about, that even though they're not really correct, enable us to think about things as correct. So, for example, how many people here believe the Earth is flat? Okay, very few people believe that, okay? But did the person who designed this building, did they think the Earth was flat? Certainly you suspect that they did, okay? They didn't worry about the curvature of the Earth when they figured out how to put the building down, okay? The person who was engineering the floor here did not worry about whether the curvature of the Earth is respected in this floor. On the scale that we're looking at things, the Earth is flat, okay? And likewise, on the scale that we're looking at things, this is how a computer works. Any questions? Okay? So, next class, you have a problem of the day to do. Remember, you have the problem of the day to do. We'll talk about the first problem of the day next class, and I look forward to seeing you then. Thanks a lot.